what we found out is that 90% of the 60 legislators we met support movable tiny houses. There are a few who do not. I was kind of shocked when one legislator actually admitted he wasn't interested in seeing his restaurant servers, his kids' teachers, or the bank clerks living in his community.
Welcome to the Tiny House Lifestyle Podcast, the show where you learn how to plan, build, and live the tiny lifestyle. I'm your host, Ethan Waldman, and this is episode 283 with Vera Strzok. I met Vera a decade ago when we were both invited to speak at Deke Diedrichsen's Tiny House Workshop in Connecticut. She explained that my first pictures of my tiny house that I built in 2012 with rain screen inspired her to deep dive into everything from thermal bridging to mold mitigation for the build of her silver bullet tiny house. When Vera takes on a project or issue, you can bet she's thorough, persistent, and resilient. Vera has been on our podcast twice before. Last time she discussed pandemic tiny house living at the very beginning of 2020. Today she will help us learn about her process of becoming an active participant in democracy to legalize the very housing product she's lived in for over a decade in Massachusetts. I asked John and Finn Kernahan of United Tiny House Association what they love about their precision temp hot water heaters, and here's what they told me.
Hey, Ethan, this is John and Finn Kernahan with the United Tiny House Association.
We organize tiny house festivals.
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
First and foremost.
We have a total of 3 precision temp on-demand hot water heaters. The thing we really like about these, and folks know this, I think they picked this up on Finn and I, if we don't like something, you'll never hear us talk about it. So the two things we noticed that we noticed and experienced immediately, they took painstaking effort to make sure that it was done right and installed. And so that was pretty cool right there. The other thing is the continuous on-demand hot water that just ran forever without any fluctuations or anything. I can't imagine an application, especially in our environment and our lifestyle of being the nomad, transportable, mobile, tiny lifestyle where one of these units aren't good to use.
Right now, Precision Temp is offering $100 off any unit plus free shipping when you use the coupon code THLP. So head over to precisiontemp.com and use the coupon code THLP at checkout for $100 off any unit. That's precisiontemp.com, coupon code THLP. Thank you so much to Precision Temp for sponsoring our show. All right, I am here with Vera Strzok. Vera Strzok has been a lifelong sustainability and environmental advocate. Overcoming 3 bouts of cancer and 2 with Lyme disease, she retired 20 years ago from a successful career in high finance, art, and consulting to pursue her intention of finding her piece of the American dream, albeit tiny. For Vera, that meant an affordable, aesthetically pleasing mobile structure made in large part of recycled and upcycled non-toxic materials. She achieved this in 2012 and took her silver bullet tiny house 17,500 miles around the U.S. as a model of how to live a zero-waste, sustainable lifestyle. 2 ebooks, 14 speaking circuits, and 4 years later, she has found she had to become a reluctant and passionate lobbyist to legalize this often misunderstood housing product. Vera Strzok, welcome back to the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Ethan. I think this is my 3rd time.
This is your 3rd time. You might be, this puts you at potentially number 1, beating out Christy Wolf and Macy Miller for my 3-time returning guest.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. So,
do I get a jacket when I get up to number 5, like SNL?
Yeah, maybe a jacket or like a mug or something. Okay. I'm a coffee fan. Maybe I'll get some Tiny House Lifestyle podcast mugs. So, tell us about your journey from being a tiny house builder and dweller to becoming kind of a lobbyist and advocate to legalize tiny houses, because those are 2 very different things.
Oh yeah, and I'm not a savvy politician. So back in 2012, the year before we met, I began my off-grid water harvesting zero-waste silver bullet tiny house build. after three bouts of cancer and, as I said, recovering from Lyme disease twice. Mm-hmm. I use 74% non-toxic recycled and upcycled materials to create a building envelope that would promote wellness and a mobile, sustainable lifestyle in a world of really ever-increasing climate change events and dwindling resources. Mm. So that led me, when I came back from my two-year tour back in 2015, to start interacting with local officials who were not very understanding of what this particular housing product is.
Mm.
Because in Massachusetts, it's classified in four different ways, depending on how you go into the DMV. It can be called a camper, a trailer with a load, a travel trailer, or an RV. So I started realizing that most of the local officials had no idea what this housing product was, how it was built, whether it was really a year-round habitable product.
Yeah. And so I'm guessing, so can you talk a little bit about the different living arrangements that you've had in terms of how was your tiny house classified? Was it, you know, was it just kind of hidden somewhere and you didn't ask permission, or what's that journey been like for you personally and interacting with the legality of living in the Silver Bullet?
I've been actually quite lucky, Ethan. Mm-hmm. Wherever I've parked 2 to 4 years, I've been hidden behind the owner's house.
Okay.
So that led to less visibility in terms of local officials accidentally seeing it. And like many other tiny house owners and dwellers, you know, we live sort of off and out away from legal attention.
Yeah.
And part of that is that I kind of felt that it was time to actually become part of the democratic process and educate officials about how to accept this particular housing product legally, instead of having all of us live that kind of, you know, hidden existence where we don't have an address, you know, we can't get DoorDash, we can't, you know, really vote without an address. So my intention was to begin that process.
Yeah. Well, and I want to say before we get into that, we're probably not going to talk too much about the Silver Bullet, but our first interview is episode 44 of this show. So if somebody is listening to this in a podcast app, they can just scroll way back to episode 44, or online, you can go to thetinyhouse.net/044 and it'll bring you right there. And we go into all about the Silver Bullet. You did it for under $20,000 without any previous building experience, without using fossil fuels, raising all the money yourself. It's like an incredible story. And I love this episode. I send it anytime someone emails me or gets in contact and says, you know, I really want to live tiny, but I just don't know if I can build it myself. I don't, you know, I'm too this, I'm too that. I said, you got to listen to this episode with Vera because, you know, on paper, she shouldn't have been able to build her own house, but she did it and did it really beautifully. So, you know, it's kind of like if Vera can do it, so can you. So was this your first kind of entry into, you know, dealing with lawmakers and getting into kind of the legal weeds?
You know, in my 20s, back in, that's right, the 60s, that's that dates me. My advocacy was limited to protests and marches and writing letters to both my federal and state congressmen and senators.
Mm-hmm.
My issues back then were the Vietnam War, free love, equal rights for women, women of color, and indigenous people's rights. I had neither the financial capital, the savvy, or network to influence the legislature, nor was political embattlement my thing.
Mm-hmm.
After 7 years struggling, as I said, to literally educate local officials about this new, in quotes, affordable housing product that could help mitigate the growing housing crisis, I learned that really in Massachusetts, there were a lot of, let me be nice here, aging inspectors and the town planners and zoning officials had no idea that this was a well-built habitable dwelling. So they just assumed and regulated it like an RV.
Yeah.
So I turned to the leaders in the community. I contacted Rich Crowley in 2020, who just recently retired from the Massachusetts BBRS, which is our state's Board of Building Regulations and Standards, who, by the way, he helped write Appendix Q back in 2018.
Nice.
The ICC Code Council passed. And in 2020, Massachusetts Governor Baker adopted. However, the only problem was that that really doesn't become legal until that code book, 2021 code book, is promulgated and published.
Right.
And that still hasn't been published. This, you know, it's going into 2024. And they assume by the end of 2024, the 2021 code book will be out there. So you can see how that is sort of strapped those of us who want to build tiny houses or movable tiny houses.
And not to mention that Appendix Q didn't even address movable tiny houses. It just addressed stationary, built on foundations.
Right. So after contacting Rich Crowley, Zach Giffen, Macy, Andrew, and Gabriella Morrison, they led me to Dan Fitzpatrick, the president of the Tiny Home Industry Association. And at the beginning of the pandemic, he encouraged me to start a task force to begin the legislative process. And after months of research, writing legislators, talking with Rich, Dan, Andrew Macy, and by the way, Corinne Watson, who legalized tiny houses in Maine. Right. I developed the courage to face what no one else was doing in Massachusetts, write a bill to define, categorize for the RMEV, and legalize movable tiny houses as year-round habitable dwellings, as either ADUs or as a primary residence. So our task force started meeting all these senators and congressmen under Dan's and my guidance. I had to learn Zoom, and you know, at my age, that's a little tough to figure out all those digital things. But anyway, we did it. And what we found out is that 90% of the 60 legislators we met support movable tiny houses. There are a few who do not. I was kind of shocked when one legislator actually admitted he wasn't interested in seeing his restaurant servers, his kids' teachers, or the bank clerks living in his community. Then I learned that he was in a district where the average house was $1.8 million. So by the time I met Senator Oliveira in December of 2022, he agreed to sponsor our bill.
Nice.
And that was filed in January 20th of this year. Now, writing the bill initially was easy. Three goals. The problem was in researching the correct language and referrals to laws and regulations and authorities, so the bill would not have to be amended every year.
Right.
At last count, prior Senator Oliveira, who last edited the bill, we had 14 revisions and edits. So it takes a long time and a lot of work. Volunteer work.
Yeah. So what does the bill say? What does it do?
Well, what it does and says is it accomplishes our three goals, which I just mentioned. Defining what a movable tiny house is, right? Making sure it has its own RMV separate category so that no longer it's in these five other amorphous, you know, categories. And it allows it to be considered a year-round habitable dwelling on both primary and ADU. But what this bill will actually do is not just legalize movable tiny houses as primaries or detached ADUs, but what it does is it also says that the local officials have the right to come in and inspect after a temporary period, because most communities have 90 to 120 days of even allowing an RV to sit on your property. And they get to come in and look at how your energy is connected, your water, and your waste stream.
Now, does the bill specify any particular certification or building code or things like that for the actual build of the tiny house? And also, as a follow-up question, answer them in whatever order. Is it still possible, you know, that a DIY tiny house, such as the Silver Bullet, could be legalized under this bill?
Interestingly enough, not only have legislators come up to tour my tiny house, view it and inspect it. So did Rick Crowley.
Nice.
And he said, Vera, you've exceeded everything. Even your connections are above and beyond. You know, with that no freeze water hose under the ground in the PVC, everything.
Yeah.
But the point is that the legislators helped me to realize to put in the bill that all the building requires to be done by the BBRS code, which is all any stick-built structure on foundation or on a chassis, okay, is regulated by that. So mine is built according to that code. So as a DIYer, anyone could inspect my house and realize it actually exceeds BBRS.
And what is BBRS?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I should explain that. This is knowledge blindness.
No, it's all good.
It's the Board of Building Regulations and Standards. It's the Massachusetts one. Other states have different versions.
Okay, got it. Well, that's, I mean, I like that. I mean, I'm sure you are aware that there's a bit of a split inside of the tiny house world as to, you know, what standards to adopt and what route to go down, whether it's certification through through the RV code or certification through the residential building code. And I really like that this bill kind of skirts around that and just says, you know, the Massachusetts building, you know, they get to decide what is acceptable in terms of how it's built.
That's basically a stick-built house, just on a chassis versus a foundation.
Yeah.
And local officials, we want to give back to them a bit of control over how it's connected to waste streams, or whether you need for your solar, in my case, you know, to have a grounding post or whatever, so that it's appropriately, you know, utilizing the local resources or safely connected properly.
Nice.
And I might add, Ethan, that, you know, the way that certification goes in this, currently in the tiny house community, is very confusing for even DIY builders.
It's confusing for me, and I interview people about it like probably every month.
I know there's the RVIA argument versus, you know, the IRC argument.
Yep.
And I would prefer to build to the IRC code and did 12 years ago, because my concept was that's where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. That's what's going to be required. Mm-hmm. The RVIA standard is so low, in my opinion, in terms of a proper building envelope, that obviously that's why it's only listed as a temporary, right?
Yeah.
Recreational vehicle. And that would never pass as a year-round habitable dwelling.
Right, right. So were you able to garner support from the tiny house community in Massachusetts and nationally at all?
Massachusetts, as you might guess, because it's so densely populated on the Eastern Shore, as most of New England, there are a lot of people who live in tiny houses, thousands. I mean, there are seven within a mile of me. Okay.
Wow.
And they're all living, you know, quietly and illegally, as I have for 11 years. And they don't want to come forward and do what I'm doing, which is essentially putting my name, face, address, you know.
Right. You're putting your neck on the line. Because if it doesn't go well, then you could end up, you know, really not being able to live in your tiny house anymore.
Right. So I've educated the task force on how to speak in a meeting. So they're not giving up their actual address. I live within a mile of this school or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they are listed voting constituents.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is that once these legislators see this, that they're an actual constituent, they realize, oh my gosh, there are probably, you know, 55 to 100 houses for every one of us who comes forward and works on a task force and writes a letter. Now, in terms of the larger national community, I have quite a bit of support, not only from ATHA, the American Tiny House Association, but also from Dan Fitzpatrick. He's with me on every meeting.
Nice.
We have at least 2 to 3 meetings a week with different legislators and leaders.
Yeah.
And so I would say that, you know, I mean, Zach Giffen has even been in on one of our meetings.
Nice.
They have written letters, national supporters, that testified in our July 27th, the big hearing. The bill goes before the Joint Housing Committee and you have a hearing. I'm happy to report that 100% of all written testifiers, in-person testifiers, and in-person for the hearing via Zoom testifiers, 100% in support of the bill.
Nice. So there hasn't...
It's Bill S-897.
Anyone
can look it up.
Yeah, we'll link to it in the show notes. Has there been any opposition to it?
None.
Not written that I know of personally. Yeah.
You know, I can only go by what the state files and the archives they have sent to me regarding testifiers.
Sure. So what are the next steps in this process?
Well, that's interesting. I had no idea what a legislative process was in our state. Mm-hmm. Lengthy. Some bills get reissued every year with a little bit better language. Our session is 2 years long.
Uh-huh.
So we have 2 years to get this bill through several committees.
Okay.
And up for a vote. So the next committee is probably the Ways and Means Committee. The Housing Committee is the hardest one to get through because they have to really look at the bill and make sure we've referred to the right chapters of the law to make sure that the DMV is okay with us doing this,
mm-hmm.
you know, which they are. And I even put a rate fee of $100 for our particular registration
mm-hmm.
because we're kind of like both a vehicle and a trailer.
Right.
Then I think they essentially move it forward to the next committee. I believe we have Ways and Means. Then after that is Finance. When that happens and it goes through its second reading, what any of our legislators could bring it up for a vote.
Okay.
The other pathway I've learned is that often governors in their second year will file a economic bill. And so we might actually be rewritten into, let's say, an ADU by right bill,
mm-hmm.
or even that, even after that, or before it, we could be thrown into the economic bill.
Interesting.
As an addendum. And then it would be signed by the governor after the conference committee looks at it.
Fascinating. So this is a multi-year process and it's not there yet.
I didn't want it to be. Yeah. I thought to myself, I'll give it 2 years. You know, I just had my 74th birthday, Ethan. I was thinking, you know, at least before I hit the ground and I'm 6 feet under, I'd like to be legal. And I'd like to help all those other folks who would like to have an affordable housing option of their own making.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. In terms of the greater, you know, the zooming out on the picture of tiny house code development and ICC and Appendix Q, you know, where as you see it, where are we in that process?
Well, actually, Dan mm-hmm. informed me that after he asked everyone to apply for this, there's a large committee made up of tradespeople, building people, code people, mm-hmm. zoning mm-hmm. people, inspection people, and even tiny house dwellers like mm-hmm. Zach, who's been involved in building as well as being a tiny house dweller, who will serve on a committee with the ICC.
Yeah,
that will start, I believe it's in a couple months. In fact, they're meeting this week.
Yeah.
And they will talk about who's going to be voted in on this committee. And then it will work towards developing what they call the movable tiny house building code.
Nice.
And very much like Appendix Q, that could later be adopted by states. So the idea is to have this, and these meetings are open, by the way, anyone can attend them. So, and they can serve on committees to do research. Like, for example, why does one part of the country not have to have this kind of insulation mm-hmm. versus another? Or should we have them all built to one insulation standard so that they could, because they're on wheels, they could travel anywhere? You know, simple questions like that is to have what put into the code.
Nice. Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know it's just a patchwork of state by state. So it's slow going, but the wheels are turning.
Well, and to add to this, you know, Dan, when I first met him was only involved with Corin Watson in the Maine legalization.
Yeah.
And then eventually, you know, of course, because he has so much experience in this.
Yeah.
Colorado called him up, you know, I mean, he's involved in the Pacific Northwest. He's done a lot of work in California on legalizing tiny houses. And this is interesting. He's been working with Florida over a year.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Again, you know, I've only been in this for 3 years, and it took that long to get us to write a bill, get one in, get support for it, get 21 co-sponsors. We have many leading senators and representatives in our group of co-sponsors. So we're excited. We're very hopeful.
Nice. Nice. So, you know, you were a tiny house builder and dweller, and now you've become an advocate and I guess you could say a lobbyist. And maybe is that the right
reluctant
thing to call you?
Reluctant lobbyist.
Reluctant lobbyist. If that's ever a memoir title, I don't know what is. You know, what advice would you have for somebody, you know, who's in a state like Vermont or like a state that has not yet really tackled movable tiny homes?
Well, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire is pretty much live free and, you know, in sort of rural, we don't care what the building is, but
not in the cities where, you know, similarly, like I live in Burlington and houses are extremely expensive here, like shockingly expensive. And so are apartments. And so it's very difficult for the teachers, the daycare workers, even the nurses, you know, to live in the city where they work. And I think tiny houses would be, you know, excellent here as a way of adding that density. And I think that, you know, even though most of Vermont is pretty, as you said, rural, and it's kind of like nobody's really checking for the cities in Vermont, the few that there are, I think that this kind of legislation is needed.
You are correct. And in fact, our task force members, just to let you know, the diversity are everything from firefighters to radiologists to nurses to students to artists to lawyers. You know, it's a huge group of people who can't afford housing. Up north of Boston, where I am, a two-bedroom is $3,200 a month. I mean, that's ridiculous when you can build a tiny house for that if you save for a year.
Yeah.
You know, it's just insane. So what I recommend is to contact Dan Fitzpatrick.
Okay.
Become a member of the American Tiny Home Industry Association because they have a lot of resources, a lot of meetings that they have that can educate you about different ways to approach it. Whether you want to go the way of, I'll deal with just local officials, see if I can get a variance or a permit, or whether you want to do what I decided to do after being frustrated years of that the best thing for me to do was to just go statewide, because that way it would require every single city and county to deal with us. And so the first thing is to develop a committee or task force of like-minded people.
Okay.
Then you write your congressmen, write your representatives and senators, state, not federal yet, but state. Okay. And maybe keep it to yourself until you gain momentum. Don't be out there doing, oh, I've been asked to be interviewed by everybody, you know, statewide. And I'm not going to do that because the pushback would be huge. And I have to spend my time right now concentrating on the bill.
Right. Right.
Later, I'll do all the Boston Globe stuff and everything and the Daily News and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I want it to be done properly with Dan present and Rich.
Yeah.
So that any questions that are asked can be dealt with. But that would be it, to write them, to meet with them, you know, become a little bit savvy in Zoom and have your constituent task force members put together a proposal, which we did, a very short, succinct PDF, great visuals talking about how our housing product is not only different than how it's being regulated and treated, but why it needs that definition in the bill and how it can mitigate the housing crisis. So that would be my advice. And I think I gave you a bunch of links
that
you can go to, at least for Massachusetts.
Yeah, those will all be in the show notes for this episode, right? So right inside the podcast app or on the show notes page. And I will say Vera assembled her own links and resources. Usually, like, I have to do it. So Vera, you're just so organized. I love it.
You gotta be. You're gonna be an advocate. Gotta be. Now you just You gotta be. So I encourage people to go forward and do this.
I'll also throw in a link to the episode. We actually had Corin Watson on the show.
I know.
A year and a half ago. So we'll link to that interview as well. I thought, you know, I want to totally shift gears. I said I wasn't going to talk about the silver bullet, but I'm just curious. For me, you know, your tiny house and my tiny house are both, you know, over 10 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if you've had to do any unexpected maintenance. Like what, is there anything in your house that hasn't held up as you had hoped?
First of all, as you know very well, Ethan, once you start living in a house, you learn, you know, which table ends will hit you in the thigh or what is not reachable properly. So you redo your shelving sometimes, or you put up your little wall thing for your projector or whatever. But tenure maintenance is crucial. So tenure maintenance, I've owned 17 other houses in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I know that you have to worry about your roof, et cetera. My roof for Brawl Steel roof required all those screws with those little rubber gaskets.
Yep.
When you're out in the sun continually or traveling as much as I did initially, they all had to be replaced. 683 screws. So my right hand was really tired, even with an impact drill.
Yeah.
And then also you have to redo your paint.
Yeah.
Those beautiful cedar siding had to be sanded, re-caulked in some places.
Few
tiny repairs.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't lost a single tiny cedar shingle, which is amazing in my 10 years.
Yeah.
So it just needed two coats more. And then I of course, changed my window color every 5 years. So it went from blue to green. Now it's a beautiful black. And I also did something else. You remember I had a deck?
Yes.
Okay, out in the back. And what I did is I moved my double doors that are on piano hinges all the way out, and it became a bedroom nook.
Oh.
So that it would give me, 67 more square feet.
Oh, boom.
That's awesome. I could actually walk around, because I had to move once I fell from my loft bed one night. Because as we get older, we have to use the facilities more often. And I got sick and tired of running up and down the stairs and fell once. So I moved my bed down.
Okay.
Other than that, there's, I think the only thing was replacing the no freeze hose. As you very well know, there are many brands out there you can get for a couple hundred.
Yep.
I went for that big one, which I think you did recently.
Me too. Yep.
But the little ends are the thing, you know, that makes all the difference, because that's what keeps the bib and the faucet.
Yeah, the pigtails.
From freezing. The pigtails are fabulous.
You know, I still froze underground last winter. We had like a week of negative 20, and where the water pipe comes up from under the ground up to the surface, it froze about a foot underground. So,
well, you know what I did?
I
did the PVC, the large PVC around his pipe that sent. What I did is I made sure that was all the way up to the bib.
Mm-hmm.
Then I made a housing around the bib connection.
Yeah.
And then insulated it. And so I've never had a problem, and I've had it for 2 years. So
yeah, this conversation is reminding me that I need to deal with that before it gets cold.
Right. And the same on the tiny house side.
Yeah.
I built this thing covering the bibs and everything. Easy.
Yeah.
It has a Tuftex latch up.
Yeah.
You know, one piece of 2-inch
insulation
to remove, and you can take a look at it at any time, and it works perfectly. So it has to be, I think, in my mind, when it goes from ground to top, it needs to be covered and insulated.
Yeah. All right. Well, Vera Strzok, thank you so much for being a guest again on the Tiny House Lifestyle Podcast. It was wonderful to catch up.
Oh, Ethan, I'm so pleased to see you again. And I love your podcast. I listen to them all the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much to Vera Strzok for being a guest on the show today. And thank you so much to Precision Temp for sponsoring today's episode. You can find the show notes, including a complete transcript, all the information that Vera and I talked about the bill in Massachusetts and how you can get involved in advocacy over at thetinyhouse.net/283. Again, that's thetinyhouse.net/283. Well, that's all for this week. I'm your host, Ethan Waldman, and I'll be back next week with another episode of the Tiny House Lifestyle Podcast.